Welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 20th, 2001, and this is a recording of Dorothy Bass talking on gathering round the hearth or not, how the presence of technology in our lives makes an even bigger difference than we might think. The tape number is 2001-3.
I'm teaching a series this week that I'm calling The Shape of Christian Living Today. Maybe you'll understand why that is a fitting title as we proceed. The main thing I've been thinking about in my work in recent years and in my life for 50-some is the question of how we can live faithfully. We have the gospel, we have the church. How does this come to life and lead us into rich and fulfilling and truthful and just, merciful lives in our daily living? And I think almost everyone who comes to Holden is concerned about that question in one way or another, in all the different contexts that we come from. Come in, please. There's some more chairs up front or on the sides. Welcome, everybody.
Excuse me.
And yet, don't we have a sense now that there's something about this society that we live in that makes it hard to live our Christian lives to the fullness? A lot of it comes to the sense in many of us that things just move too fast. Okay. Is this making sense? That, you know, I'd like to, but I don't have time. We also are concerned about the distractions of media. I think the other kinds of messages that surround us, often the materialism of our culture, all the things that cumber us and weigh us down and distract our attention. It's making sense. These feel like burdens that that make it more difficult in our lives to live as faithful people. Okay? Well, I read a book this year that I just thought was tremendously helpful to me in thinking further about this matter. And as soon as I read it, I thought, I've got to share this with people at Holden. It's just a Holden book. It's just a great book. It's called Transforming Our Days, Spirituality, Community, and Liturgy in a Technological Culture, by a young Roman Catholic theologian named Richard Gagliardi. I ordered it for the bookstore, but it has not arrived. I'm sorry. I'm going to lead us all in walking through the argument of this book, which I think opens up some really interesting ways of thinking about how we live and how that impacts who we think we are, who we think God is, what we think the world is, and I hope that, and I think also that it has some wonderful suggestions for things we can actually do to claim our Christian lives more fully. Come in, there are a few more chairs up here.
Can you close the shade?
Yeah. Please.
Sit in front of the
chair. Four more chairs. That's okay.
Sure.
People may end up sitting on tables. I'm going to lead you through a three-step argument. Okay? And it'll take probably the whole hour to make the argument. By the end, we'll have some suggestions, I think, of what we might do in our lives to resist some of the cultural and pressures that that trouble us as we try to live as we think we should. So here's step one. First step is to come on in. Come on in. Welcome. We saved you. Those who are last are first. We have some places at the front here. Is it like coming late to church in your church? And up right in the front. Welcome. The Lord thinks that we will not really be able to grab a hold of our cultural situation and forge good lives if we do not understand the way in which technology shapes our lives. It's not a matter of how do you use it, Do you use it well? Do you use it badly? It's not a matter of very intricate questions like should we clone, should we not clone? We're talking about the very simple technologies that surround us on a daily basis in our lives. And that's abstract. The best way to get into it is to explore this concept. Okay? I want you to think about the difference between a fireplace and a central heating system. Okay, now, and we'll start with a fireplace. Let's talk about a fireplace. Okay, why do people have those two things, basically, in their homes? To stay warm. Okay, that is the basic good that's going to come out, and either a fireplace can produce it or a central heating system can produce it, right? Fine. But what does the fireplace have to have in order to produce heat?
Wood.
Wood. Okay. Can you get the wood from inside your house? No. You have to go outside of your home, right? And what do you have to do? Do you just gather the wood? What else do you have to do to the wood? Chop it, right?
Dry it.
Can you have it right this minute? If you don't have any wood, then you're in. You have to haul it. You have to give it time to dry. You have to chop it.
You have to put it in the fire.
You have to do that. That's very hard. You have to kind of build it just the right way, right? You have to put in some kindling and shape. Would you like a chair? Something out here? Now just think about all that goes into a fireplace. Okay, so there's lots that just plain goes into making a fire, right? And could we say that there's some skill involved, right? Could we say that there's an engagement with nature? We have to know something about nature, right? Some knowledge of nature, which kind of wood is going to burn and which kind isn't, okay? Time for drying. And all that.
Someone has to teach you.
Teaching, great. Human relationships. All kinds of human relationships. Okay, teaching, a teacher, so that parents teach children have kind of graduated, right? First of all, gather the little twigs, and then learn to add another log, and then learn to chop, right? So there's a graduated knowledge that teaching. Does the heat come out? Yes. What else happens?
It's work.
Work? Okay. Yeah, it is work.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You have to have the fire.
Excuse me?
You have to have the fire.
You have to have
the
right?
Source.
Okay. And that takes some skill and some, sometimes tending, right, over a long period of time. I think pioneer families would have one fire that would kept going for months, maybe longer.
You have to tend the fire.
Tending, okay? And perhaps we imagine people working out rhythms of chores where I'll tend it today and you tend it tomorrow, or it's my job to start it in the morning, it's your job to start it at night. Okay, so rhythms of life are springing up around this, right? Rhythms? And we're not going to get the kids up for breakfast until the fire's been going for a while, things like this, all right? So we've got rhythms. Does the heat come out equally in every room of the house?
No.
So where's the family going to be in the evening? Together, the community grows up. Where are they going to have their conversations? Right? Where are they going to become a social group? And not just a group, but one that also is tending a fire. And going outside to get wood, and not just staying inside with their own little self, but they're going outside to get wood, they're learning about nature, right? Okay? The Lord, in setting this forth as the first chapter, is drawing on this philosopher named Albert Borgmann. If any of you ever encountered his work, he's at the University of Montana. Some of you may know Larry Rasmussen. He draws on Borgmann's thought a great deal in a book of his, Moral Fragments and Moral Community, that's over in the bookstore. Borgmann's too complicated to, and it doesn't make the theological applications. Gilardi is going to do that. Okay, so is this concept of Bergmann's, the concept of the focal thing, actually the word focus in Latin means heart. So there's a focal thing that gives rise to a whole social life, in a sense, which includes, which in which human capacities are exercised, and nature is engaged, and community emerges. And focal things and the focal practices that go along with the focal things lead us into manifold engagement with the world and with one another. You see how this is true of a fireplace? Leads us into all kinds of engagement, not just the heat. We get the heat, but we also get all kinds of other goods. And the source of it, it's not easy, it's a burden. And that's the term, friction. It doesn't just go smoothly. We might fight, well, no, it's your turn to go out and chop. No, it's your turn, right? And it takes time. We become aware of our limits, our finitude. Right? So, it produces heat, but the focal thing and the focal practices that surround it also produce manifold other goods. And some burdens too. Now, what about a central heating system?
Thermostat.
All you have to know is where the thermostat is.
Children usually can't reach it or participate.
Okay, right. Central heating system. What else?
Cost.
Okay. It forces you into a market, a larger market, right? And Amish who don't bring electricity and I presume natural gas into their homes, it's not because they don't want to have lights. They do have kerosene lights. It's because they don't want to be dependent on that web, that market web, that is snaking now into their home and keeping them dependent on that web. Okay? They might have even a generator. It's not anti-technology, it's a question of who's being involved in that market. Okay? Great, okay, here we go. So we're into a market, a different kind of market, an impersonal market. I mean, there firewood is a market too, potentially, but it might be more personal. Okay? You have no kids, no skill.
And you don't have any control. What's happening in California if they turn off the gas flow?
Yeah,
these are roast.
People from California have been learning that. Right? So real dependence on an anonymous larger world. Right? Now, is nature involved in the central heating system? Yeah, it is. But do we know that really on a daily basis? Is there anything we don't think about? It's one of the basic characters of a device is that it hides the actual cost to the earth. Okay, it hides. There are human relationships that are taking place around our central heating. Right, there are workers out there, but I don't know them. And they're hidden, right? Mm-hmm. See this? Any other features? Yeah.
The feature of the device is you get when yours breaks and you get a new one, you get a manual to read about doing it. You don't really get a manual about building a fire. It's oral tradition. Passed on.
Right. Wow. Okay. And in a sense, you maintain a device.
Mm-hmm.
And you tend a fire. There's something. I don't know what that difference is.
Well, you call somebody.
Or you call somebody else, right?
Mm-hmm. That's what I was going to say, too. Yeah. You have a service.
Right. It's a very specialized bit of knowledge. There's knowledge involved, but that's hidden from me. Only a few very specialized people who went to heating thermostat school know that. Right? It's not a shared knowledge. Anything else?
Well, it's also automated.
Yeah, automated. Oh, great. And that means automated. This brings in the realm of time. Okay? It has no rhythms.
It's automatic.
You can set it. We put ours down a little bit in the night and up a little bit in the day. But you can turn on and it instantly comes. And you're not going to be planning your family schedule around this, right? It takes you, in a sense, it even overrides in our home in Indiana, which has both air conditioning and heating. It overrides the seasons, in a sense. It lets us ignore at least spring and fall if we want to.
Yeah. Well, a big problem though is in the automatic one, when there's a power outage, you have no heat at all. Mm-hmm. If you have a fireplace, you can survive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Right.
I think it also. Mm-hmm. I think it also lets you live in places that you would never have lived before. And in a real sense, I think, is anti-nature.
Uh-huh.
Because people go to Arizona, where it's 120 degrees, and live there with air conditioning on all summer long.
Right.
Or they go to live in Alaska with, you know.
Right. Right. Now, so it is engaged with nature, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's doing things to nature.
Yeah.
But that is hidden from the... there's only one word for the human being who lives this way, the consumer. Right? The consumer, yeah.
I was thinking the other thing that's hidden has to do with, more recently, we have all these warnings about how fireplaces produce smoke that's unhealthy. And again, if you have other kind of heating, it may be good for your health, but it pushes the health concerns elsewhere.
Right, right, right. It hides. So the key features, we're getting there, the key features of a device are all these in contrast, but it hides our place in the natural world and in time and geography and in labor relations. It hides the truth of the world from us. And it also disburdens us, right? Not my health will be fine, right? Yes.
It gives you more discretionary time. You don't have to maintain the fire, so you've got more time to do other things.
That's the basic meaning of disburdenment, okay? So then it is disburdening, isn't it? I mean, to add fireplace tending to our lives is not, it's not going to happen. Okay. I promise this is not heading towards guilt trip. But it's just interesting. Let's try one or two more thought experiences of this kind, because I think it's such an interesting concept. A device I have at home, the garbage disposal. Okay, and it's augmented by the weekly pickup, which is sorted into plastics and glass and paper and so on, which for recycling. But it's augmented, and basically we're pretty much disburdened from getting the good, which I think the good is having room under your kitchen sink for other things, you know? So not having to keep your garbage forever is the good in this case, all right? And same with we have a great focal practice here at Holding, and I don't know how many of you know this focal practice. What am I thinking of?
Composting
and the whole garbology.
Yeah.
Right? The compost heap is a focal thing. The focal practice is the practice of garbology. Hey, are there any of you who are new to Holden who don't know about garbology? Relationships grow up on garbology. Right? You grow into relationship with others, and so much that is hidden by those devices of garbage disposal at home is disclosed here in the practice of garbology. We sort out everything in the trash cans into different recycling bins, and we take the garbage up to the third level. Okay? It's a focal practice of life at Holden, I would suggest.
And then if you go there, you have a smell. You have an odor that you don't have at a garbage disposal.
Mm-hmm. Right. So there's a disburdenment of smell. Right? The garbage disposal disburdens us of smell. And there's some truths about, now we're not making judgments here about whether we should or shouldn't use these things, okay? We're just understanding how the world works.
I don't want to get ahead of you here. You may be working towards this, but the other thing that I think is true of devices is that they're they're designed to save us time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But the fact of the matter is that everybody complains about not having enough time. We're all too busy, and it seems like the more of these things we get, the less time we have.
Right. Boardman talks about, he says, what these authors want us to say now is, not only do we use these devices, some of them are very useful, and many of them are very useful and very helpful and have truly disburdened those who have them of some things that we, you know, technology has done many good things for humankind. However, we now get so infatuated with the device paradigm that we want our commodity right now. And to hide as much of the machinery, and to hide as much of the impact on nature, and to disburden ourselves from as much of as possible, including time. And so now we're into this constant barrage of commodities, which we can get at the moment's notice. And we're infatuated by hyperspeed, hyperreality, you know, brilliant. Don't you get a better wilderness experience at Disney's Wilderness Lodge than if you actually took the time to trudge all the way to, you know, into the wilderness where you might not even see a bear? We want it right now, and we live in hyper reality, hyper speed. There's a couple other hypers. Okay, so and something's happened to our humanness in this situation.
Oh, your example there just made me think of when I went to see the movie A Bug's Life in the theater, and there's this, I think it's the opening scene even, where the camera, if there is even a camera involved in the making of it, is kind of panning up to this tree, and this tree has got these shimmering leaves that are blowing in the breeze, and it was just, I was sitting there in awe, it was breathtaking seeing that. And I thought, why is it when I walked in and I saw the tree outside, I didn't have a breathtaking experience when I saw a real tree here in the movie theater. Just enthralled with the technology and the creativeness of it.
Right. Hyperreality is brilliant. And we become bored with the mundane. Mm-hmm. Hyperreality is instantly accessible. We become too lazy to hike and get a really good view of a really good bear,
I think we really see this in a lot of our congregations now, particularly at this point in time where we've had such an escalation of technology over the last number of decades, and the older folks in our congregation are able to take 30 seconds of silence is really nice. For the kids, it's an eternity. They have no idea what it means to sit in silence for 30 seconds, and we struggle with not losing them in the worship experience, and not having things go so fast that the older folks, or the people who crave silence, really regardless of their age, can have that worship experience too.
Right. Okay, great. And is worship itself even threatened by habituated to life under the device paradigm? Right now, with real clear products, a certain feeling. So we can hold that thought. Fulton practices, we should probably keep moving through this material, but the culture of the table is a really good example. Food, our engagement with food, the microwave dinner as a device, the festive meal as a focal practice, focal thing. You could go through the same. It's what happens at a festive meal, all these things, right? And what happens when you eat a microwave dinner. So, make sure I've got all this in here I want to. So that the full thing realizes goods besides the commodity. Okay? But it also brings burdens. Well, a device produces the commodity only. Okay, we're doing great here. There are both Gilardi and Borgman, and certainly I, are not saying that we should not use any devices or that technology is in itself a bad thing. Okay? We are trying to say to people, look, it's not that technology is neutral, and how you use it is the question. The question is the technological character of contemporary life somehow shaping our expectations of who we are and what the world is by hiding certain truths from us in our daily living? So this is the question. So it's not a matter of how you use it, it's what does it do to your whole perception of who you are and your place in the world when we live under the device paradigm. That Borgman says there's a characteristic way of taking up with the world. A way of taking up with the world that is resident in this paradigm, which involves delivering commodities without attention to the limits of time and space, without engagement with other people and the natural world, without the necessity of skill or the possibility of excellence. One of the definitions of technology that's kind of thrown in here is the knack of so arranging the world that we do not experience it. What do you think? Does this make some sense so far? Mm-hmm. You want to object to the basic? That is a very provocative way of thinking. All right. Now, what do we learn? We get all those great commodities. What do we learn in the meantime? Okay, let's try a few things. The more mundane spheres of human life are devalued. Does this make sense? Okay, the actual cooking, even childcare, the daily things that take time and that involve us with the material world. Okay? Right? The more mundane spheres of human life are devalued. Human goods are transformed into mere commodities. We're kind of pulled into further and further into a market system, anonymous big market. We are relieved of burdens. But burdens, well, we'll get back to burdens in a minute. Burdens are not all bad. And we are taught to think that perhaps eventually we can master time itself and not be constrained by time. And in this context, that's as far as Borgman takes us. Now the rest is Gilardi. In this context, it is increasingly difficult to be open to the grace and blessings that come to us in our basic human activities. Life at the table, which can be such a graced time. Just the meal with friends. Be so graced. And it's crowded out. You lose the skills and even the sense that we ought to save time for such things. We miss that grace and blessing. The valuing of the ordinary work, which is part of Luther's doctrine of vocation, that in all of our work we're involved with God and caring for creation, right? The care and redemption of all that you have made. The sense of that all things, if we attend closely, we're not going to have time to attend closely now, but if we're attending closely to things, that you can find something of God's creativity in all of those things. That these moments of grace and blessing are farther and farther away because of the very structure, the material structures within which we live. That's the claim. I want to read one little quotation. Gilardi is saying it's not only futile to try to dismantle modern technology. We wouldn't get away with it, right? But we benefit from many of its advances, and that's fine. But he says, what we must seek is a realistic and measured reform of the paradigm. What is required is conscious reflection on one's life with a view toward identifying and cultivating vital focal practices. The conscious identification and preservation of focal practices will help restrain the device paradigm, keeping the employment of devices within their proper sphere. After all, our principal difficulty is not technology itself, but our inability to differentiate between the central life practices that we wish to preserve because they bring meaning and grace, and those spheres of life for which efficiency and cost-benefit analysis ought properly to reign. Certain devices that do are cost-efficient, and we need to reform them to make them good for the earth and so on, but that are helpful. And others that bring blessing and grace, and how can we build up some of those? All right. So that's step one, vocal practices and devices. All right. Now, Gilardi wrote this book because of his conviction, which I think is very clear and wonderful and useful at this moment. The basic Christian beliefs call us to resist this thinning of our engagement with the world and with one another. Okay. What convictions? First, an awareness of that all existence is graced. Comes from God, all that is comes from God. Okay. The mystics help us to see this, the Psalms help us to see this in celebrating the world. Trees clapping their hands and all the rest. It's a constant in Christian theology to think of the material world as God's gift. Okay. So that is a fundamental Christian belief which comes in handy in this moment of cultural crisis. But secondly, that what the world might call burdens also make possible our deepest fulfillment. The burden of taking just one partner in marriage, for example, and restricting the rest. The burden of caring for a child. Even the burden of suffering at certain times. Jan Boven has been talked in her homily and has spoken in her sessions about how becoming ill opened up whole realms of blessing to her, as she accepted that she was not the person she had been before as the unstoppable professional. Okay? The burdens, the shape of human living almost, is for what might be seen as burdens, as restriction, to be places where we also experience blessing. And indeed that if we back off from all burden, okay, we don't want to ever be hurt, so we're not going to get in a relationship. Okay? We don't want to ever suffer, so we're not going to go in a room where someone is sick. Okay? We don't want to ever be criticized, so we're not going to ever talk to anyone outside of our own class and race. Okay? That it's in the burdens, going into a place where we might be criticized, the accepting of care for another human being, that our own deepest fulfillment emerges. And Catholics call this the Paschal mystery, the Paschal shape of human living. The Easter, that means Easter, the Easter shape, the cross and resurrection shape, that it's in when we enter into the reality of our mortality, of the cross in a sense, that we also experience rich life. Are you with me on this so far? Okay. And he said, the basic Christian conviction that grace, blessing, and the possibility of salvation do not come to us in the progressive manipulation of time and maximization of consumption that technology offers. Right? Basic Christian belief. That's not what happiness is all about. It's not the consumer paradise. Rather, they come to us in the conscious attentiveness to the signals of the divine that glimmer in basic human engagements and in the free acceptance of the constraints of time and the burdens of human commitment. The true blessings of life can never be simply ready at hand. Rather, they surprise us in the midst of daily living. This, then, is the central wisdom of Christianity that needs to be brought to our technological, consumer-driven world. We find human fulfillment precisely when we cease making fulfillment the immediate end of all our actions, and instead give ourselves over freely to lives of committed service and love. Make sense? Is anybody else hot?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You don't have an air conditioner here. So we're going to have to engage with nature here.
Okay.
Appreciating everything in the way that I just described, right? Kind of be aware of these as abstract truths. But Gilardi wants to argue that if we're doing that and living unchallenged within the device paradigm, it's going to fritter away. We're not going to get very far. Can you live completely as a consumer, okay? Always expecting instant gratification. And also take on the burdens of commitment and notice the sacred that glimmers through all of life. Okay, that's the question. But we have some another way into the path through. Okay? And here, Christian liturgy is itself a focal practice that makes concrete and visible the grace of God in ordinary life and the paschal shape of life. Okay, now let's stop and think about Christian liturgy, and let's think of a Eucharistic service as itself a focal practice, first of all, which passes on an oral tradition, which takes skill to participate in, especially if you're a Lutheran, I think, all those books and so on, you know, big words, which brings nature, which gathers, speaks of the grain gathered in, and actually embodied things, embodied people are brought, holy things are brought into the liturgy. It takes time, right? It takes time and transforms time. I mean, there we are in that hour or so. And we're also remembering a time long ago, we're anticipating an eschatological time, we're anticipating a time beyond fulfillment. Okay, it takes time, it also makes something else of time. It takes time to go to church. Simply, right? It just takes that time. And it leads us through a whole year of time, every time, right? It takes time. We're taught to participate in it. Work, liturgy is the work of the people. Right? We honor its source, we tend its vestments and the space. Right, there are rhythms of worship, and it draws us into community. I mean, go on and on. It's in concrete reality. A Christian worship service is a focal practice. Are you with me on this? Okay. But it also is a focal practice that teaches us about all the other practices. It gathers. It says, "Look in this material thing at this table." God is present. And then we experience the other tables of life differently. Okay? It takes, it makes concrete and visible the other practices. Take the practice of hospitality. In a worship service, let the Lord be with you. Right? Come to the table. There are concrete visible things which actually shed light on the other practices of life that are going to be happening the rest of the week. Kind of gather them up and show the relationship to the holy. You see, are you with me on this? I don't know. Okay. Let me keep going and see. The grace of God in ordinary life, that other kind of principle, which might be abstract, is very concretely proclaimed and shared in bread and wine, and we hope lived out in that community of people, right? The presence of God. It's a place to practice this conviction that God is present in ordinary life. We practice that in our relationships, in the congregation. And we're sent out aware of that. And this whole idea that life has a pastoral shape, that it's in the receiving of burdens, the burden of one another, which we could be, can't we? That we will find our way to fullness of life. That also is really crystallized in the liturgy. Baptism itself says that. It's in the loss of, when you die in baptism, that you rise again to new life. And this is enacted concretely in the situation of worship. We come and confess, first of all. It's also a paschal act. Confess our sin and gain absolution and go out again. So that in Christian liturgy, we have a focal practice which engages us with each other and with nature in the way that any focal practice does. Come together at a certain time and do some things that take some skill. But it also is a focal practice that points to the presence of God in ordinary life and other practices, and to the paschal shape of our living. I'm not seeing the ahas here. Let's talk the fireplace. So what are the questions or the stumbling points on this? Any? Dan.
One thing that strikes me as maybe a paradox or a creative tension, and what we're focusing on here is that we learn through the special religiosity that we imbue these things with, and at the same time if we sacralize them too much, they lose their power to inform us in our daily life. So that I'm thinking of a guy named Doug Adams who teaches worship at a UCC seminary, who likes to say that it's hard to say this almost, but that maybe we should, for communion, we should use Kool-Aid and pretzels, because that would be a strong tie to our daily life, and we forget that the bread and the wine were common elements. It was a regular, that we want to learn how all of our meals should be through communion.
Right. Yeah. No, that's interesting. That if we get, it's possible to take the practice of doing church and make it almost an art form, which doesn't connect back.
Right.
Kind of what you're saying. But it gets very, kind of has such old and elite symbols involved in it, and people don't know what they are, and the connections don't get made. Right. So this whole approach that I'm talking about would call us to really make sure and do that teaching of this focal practice, and to do it in such a way that it's real. Yeah, thank you.
I think, though, the opposite danger is to turn liturgy in Christian worship into a device, and to take anything that's difficult out of it. I always chuckle to myself and sometimes almost cry when I lift the communion bread and it's in the perfect shape of a bread machine. It's an example of a way maybe time might be better spent to have people gather and make bread. Spend time. Or if there are words, Kyrie, Eucharist, words that aren't immediately accessible to new people, well, that's a perfect reason for people to talk and to share what those words mean.
Right. No practice can live on its own. Right, and there's almost a sense that if you start getting one practice into good shape, even worship, that other practices will flourish around it. Bread baking, mm-hmm. and music making, and other practices that would hold up and sustain that one. That's a great example. Yeah,
I think I've always objected, well not always, but recently started to object to even the term "we're going to church" as opposed to "we are the church." We're going to be the church. Because I think there has become, because we are so entertainment-oriented these days, that the pastor is the focal thing. Uh-huh. And so, you know, therefore, the pastor is to perform, and the choir is to perform, and we are to sit here and watch and criticize, mm-hmm. as opposed to being the music and helping. I've always liked black services because, you know, when the preacher preaches, the audience is "preach it, sister," or "bring it on home," or "shut up," or whatever it is they say. But I mean, you really feel this interaction, which, you know, I mean, I look out in a sea of faces that look like, well, all right, so then what, you know? Mm-hmm. But I think we've been trained, mm-hmm. to kind of do that.
And is, you know what Borglon and Gagliardi would say that is that even church is getting sucked into the device paradigm. Mm-hmm. And as a Catholic, Gagliardi would say, well, you know, people want to be there for 20 minutes, get their wafer and run. Mm-hmm. It's like a wafer and shoot. You know, I've been thinking about, you know, what's the Protestant parallel? And I think, you know, without engagement, to consume some good music, to receive an experience with as little investment of myself as possible, you know, in an entertainment-oriented church. See, that's the device paradigm. So how do we... Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, another way for more like a device of getting there is the time, because it has to be very timed, mm-hmm. to fit into other things on Sunday. Mm-hmm. And it isn't like we could spend a little bit more time doing this. Mm-hmm. It has to be efficient. Mm-hmm. Some of us had a discussion once about having drive-through communion.
Well, it's been done.
You know, it's been done.
I saw something in Lutheran magazine. You know, we guarantee you a 40-minute service, including communion. Yeah. And I think you can go to the Christ Cathedral in your car.
Yeah.
And sit in the car and never get out. And so, the whole sense of social engagement as a good and necessary part of the full human life. But there are two different visions of the human life and what is a good human life that are going on here. You know, one, the good human life is to be disburdened of all the, you know, of all the frictions and the work and the effort and just to receive the best of commodities of all kinds. Right? And this is kind of the life of that's depicted in a lot of movies and so on. And a Christian vision of life, which says, no, in those burdens of actually belonging to a congregation and putting up with those other people and, you know, learning to love them, is that's more what life, what the good human life is.
But it was our desire for disburdenment that created all those consumer products out there that we all go out and buy.
Okay, let me take this to the last step, and then it'll just be a discussion, okay? So that's good. So Gagliardi has two recommendations for Christians trying to live in this technological society, once we open our eyes to what's going on in terms of this analysis. One is to nurture and love that practice of liturgy, and to make it as plain as possible how it relates to everything else, and let it be the place where we're reminded and reoriented to the basic realities of the world, that we are mortal and that this is God's world and all the rest, right? That we are there reoriented to the truth. And also to, in our own context, to choose a few focal practices that your community can do, and to do them, and to, instead of worry about which devices should we not use, some good stuff in place, and those thin devices that don't really engage us in our depth will fall away. I mean, you know, join a community orchestra and you'll watch less television. You know, what about retreat? When I read this book, I mean, I felt like, sometimes I'm sitting there making dinner, I'm saying, well, where's everybody else? I'm feeling kind of oppressed, you know. I thought, isn't it great that I kept making dinner? I felt like this was wonderful, you know? The culture of the table is one that they recommend, you know, that seems clear to retreat, to insist on some festive meals together at some times. Make sense? So he's saying, go to liturgy and understand it and listen carefully, intend it well and keep it alive and listen closely to its realities and to be reoriented and choose some focal practices that can bring your family and your community together in all of these ways. Just choose some, and they don't all have to be the same. But find some people and put some focal practices in place in connection with that living liturgy, which is part of your now part of your life. That's what I want to share with you. I'd like to hear your responses and what you all think, what focal practices come to mind as ones that might be nurturing in your communities, whether this makes sense or would work.
Another place that we do that, I'm thinking about exercise. People, you know, drive to the health center mm-hmm. to use the devices. and I drive to the YMCA
as close as possible.
That's right.
Instead of walking somewhere uh-huh. or taking a walk in nature, which then is a focal mm-hmm. activity. Uh-huh. Another thing that I observed once in a home, a rather small home, and this woman said that they had had family there for Christmas. And I was trying to visualize, well, where, because it was cluttered and crowded. And in her kitchen and her living room, those two rooms, there was no table. So you have to imagine how they eat mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. in front of the TV sitting on the couch, I think.
Right.
And that was kind of shocking to me, but I'm sure it's from lots of homes.
I think it happens in quite a lot of homes. And in the car, I think, is what I hear about a lot. You know, driving through fast food between soccer practice and music lesson or something. And, you know, that might just be the way it is on many days a week. But there's also a family tradition of the festive table that is really nurtured and which people are drawn into. I may be an accommodator, but I'd say, okay, so three nights a week you don't eat together or whatever. That's life. But there's this other countervailing thing which is being lovingly tended.
This isn't intended to be preachy, but we're vegetarians and we have a 5-year-old. And so when we are going someplace, we have to think ahead of time about packing a lunch mm-hmm. because there are very few vegetarian fast foods, which we actually would like more of them. but it really causes us to think ahead about our day, where we're going to go, what we need to be packing.
Right. Yeah, interesting. Right. The device paradigm is not quite in place for vegetarians. And it might be a reason to be a vegetarian in a sense. I mean, some people that I know who are seem to be very engaged with the food and, you know, in a certain kind of way. Even to teach, you know, to take the kids to the grocery store and how do you know what's a ripe melon and what isn't? You know, there's some knowledge there, some sharing, some intergenerational culture and as one of the quotations said, and the possibility of excellence. You know, the possibility of human excellence is there in a way that it's not without these global practices.
Yes, Rosie. It's interesting that with technology, the phone can almost be a focal practice now, you know, whereas it was once new technology. Mm-hmm. And in our organization, our CEO has rebelled against email to maintain a phone and a conversational kind of message system. And she's been forced into it because some people will just email her and she'll get them, but she'll return the phone call. But the phone is a focal practice for her.
It has become that now.
Because it means she will use her voice to talk with people.
That's interesting. And that's the kind of prudential judgment. Mm-hmm. It's one person's prudential judgment, which is the kind of judgments that I think, if there's any legitimacy in this analysis, that they'd be called to make. Holden has to make such judgments as a community. What are the ways in which it would be good to disburden this community, this village, of some of the dangers of our isolation? And we try to do everything possible to do that. What are the ways in which if we didn't have to do garbology, we might do it anyway. What are the focal practices that are still life-giving? One other thing. If you think about it, I think that as a device the CD player, the greatest music possible, perfectly reproduced right now. Well, is that a good or not device? I would submit that it's an excellent device, but it's more excellent for those who also participate and know the focal practice of making music live and real with actual wooden and metal things, with vocal things. That in the presence of a focal practice, technology has a promise that is more full than in the absence of that. Similarly with sports. I mean, too, if simply, you could say, just having the greatest athletes constantly on the television would discourage others from engaging in their practice. But, a kid who's a soccer player and not even very good can really appreciate great soccer on the television without thinking, therefore, I'm not going to play soccer anymore. And it's kind of a mutual feed. Right, a mutual helpfulness of device and practice at that point. Arguing that soccer is a practice there. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So, how do we not let this device, this just becoming consumers of commodities, take over? But where do we put down our stake and say, this one's worth holding on to? This live music or this this table fellowship or wheat crafts or whatever the focal practice might be for you.
I was just thinking, I guess it's different for different individuals and it's different for different families about the kinds of things that they hold on to. But I think everybody wants to hold on to some parts and let other parts go.
Okay, you're right. Right.
I just remember raising my children when I wanted them home at 6 o'clock or I wanted a phone call as to why they weren't going to be there. And lots of times they didn't make it by 6 o'clock dinner, but they always called. But, quite often some of us would have dinner together at least most of the time. It was an attempt that we constantly made.
Right. Yes.
I think another important thing is to have either a family meeting or lots of communication between people so that, and that's the thing that I sabotage immediately because I'm too busy to meet together. Mm-hmm. And therefore you can really decide on the focal point. Otherwise it seems like we really have difficulty doing that. You just kind of go back into our busyness.
Right.
And I was struck by the worship component you said. At our church, I don't know if any of other churches here have worship committees, but they what happens is the worship committee have so much to plan that it's just kind of, we need to do this and this and this and this, and then we're done. 2 hours, we're done. For 3 months worth of planning. At our church, we decided to include some of the artists in getting some creative ideas of what we could do for worship, and we had another meeting with them,
and they passed on the information of what they believe, what they would like to see. And so that's kind of the direction we're moving in there to supplement. So I'm not saying that all meetings are good either, because they can become very rote and just doing the business. Mm-hmm. So appreciate what you said about worship.
Yeah.
The work of the people.
Yeah, and you that are leading into the idea of conversation as itself a focal practice, mm-hmm. which is endangered by email, by people's schedules, and other things.
I have found the device of email real helpful mm-hmm. in increasing mm-hmm. communication between family and friends.
Mm-hmm.
I have much more contact because it's so easy to do.
It might be a very good device in your context. Anne, did you ever do that?
Well, I was thinking recently because I have an elderly mother who's living across the country, I've been spending more time in a different congregation. And it just is interesting to watch what congregations hold on to and the logic, because we live in a smaller city that's near nature, and our congregation hangs on to a lot of family sorts of things within the worship, and good music is important, good preaching is important. There's sort of these family kind of casual things. And then my sister and my mother live in San Francisco, and the church they belong to has a lot of quiet, you know, a lot of spaces. Mm-hmm. And at first I was thinking of it as just a stylistic thing, and then I thought, no, this is really functional when you're living in a big city, when you're commuting, mm-hmm. to go to church and not have folksy sort of chaos sometimes, mm-hmm. but to have quiet.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was just really eye-opening to me to suddenly realize why it was really nourishing and mm-hmm. a good focal practice. To, yeah. After every element, there's a sort of a stop, uh-huh. quiet.
That's interesting. No, we're just about out of time. Bob, maybe this last comment?
I don't need to say anything. It's okay.
Anybody really have something to add on this? Let me just, as I say, I ordered this book, Transforming Our Days, which is very readable, but it didn't make it to the bookstore just yet. Maybe it will show up at some other point. I noticed that Larry Rasmussen's book, there are several copies there. I wasn't the one to order it, but Moral Fragments and Moral Communities. He runs through the same analysis.
It's on the sales table.
So does who?
I think it's on the sales table.
It was on the sales table. Yes,
that's
right.
Better.
Yes, it was on the sales table. There are lots of problems. And he wants us to... He's really aware of how difficult it is to form communities of practice these days, and he wants us to do that, practice to do that. The Holden Village, I don't know if you've seen Good Courage, which is a quarterly journal of ideas that comes out from Holden, and it's in the bookstore also. And a couple years ago, there was a special issue on technology, which is very interesting. I think it's a very good issue. And... also in the library, in the bookstore, I didn't order it, but it's very good, is my favorite book by Kathleen Norris, who you may know as the author of Dakota and Cloister Walk, called The Quotidian Mysteries, Laundry, Liturgy, and Women's Work. And the quotidian means every day, you know, the mysteries of everyday life. It's just a lovely little book. It starts off when she is observing Roman Catholic Mass, and the priest is, you know, they kind of swirl water around in the chalice and so on, and fold the linen, and she says, he's washing the dishes. That's the beginning point. So I recommend all these works, and thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you.